Thank you, Father John, and it is indeed a blessing to be here today. Christ is risen.
He is risen.
Yes, it's so great to be here today. Father and John and I were internet friends for a long time. He shares an interest in the scriptures along with me, and I've benefited from his comments, and we've shared a lot. And today I'm here to talk about the book of Revelation, and I'm really grateful that he invited me to speak about this today. So what we're going to do, because we have a very limited amount of time, only about 3 hours that we're going to devote to this topic, I'm just trying to give you an understanding initially of what Revelation is about, and then we'll talk about some famous images that you're all familiar with, and then lastly we'll talk about the ending of Revelation, and also what is the purpose or what is the message of the book for us today. So we'll go ahead and begin. Well, there we go. So, Revelation. This book is known by two names. It is frankly the only book in the Bible known by two names. There are certain things that are unique about the book of Revelation. And first of all, it's the only apocalyptic book in the Bible. And you'll see that that's something very special. There are other portions of the Bible which are apocalyptic, parts of Daniel, parts of the Synoptic Gospels, but this is the only one that is almost entirely apocalyptic in nature. It's also the only book of prophecy in the New Testament. As we said, there are prophetic passages. The Lord makes prophecies, but this is the only book that is primarily prophecy. It's also unique in other ways. It is the only book which tells people to read it, which is interesting. If you think about that, we don't see that. It also blesses the reader. It blesses the listeners, because in those days, people primarily interfaced with books by listening to them being read aloud. Books were not a common thing. And so usually one person would read and others would listen. It's also the only book in the Bible that I know of that was accepted as scripture widely within the church, then rejected, and then accepted again. And this pattern happened only in the East, not in the West. It was never rejected in the West, but it was rejected in the East. And it's the only book, as I said, that is known by two names, Revelation and Apocalypse. Revelation is based on the Latin word. Apocalypse is based on the Greek word for the book. And they both mean to uncover or to reveal, hence the name Revelation. This is also an interesting for us in the Orthodox tradition. This is the only book which is never read in church. All right? So let's talk about, this is what we're going to discuss. So what we're going to do is look at these particular points. First of all, we're going to talk about what apocalyptic literature is, whether or not Revelation can be used to predict the end of the world, why it is so strange, and who the author was, why he wrote it, and what is the historical content. That's all in this hour. So let's go ahead and start with this question of what is apocalyptic literature. So the book of Revelation is not the only book that is written in this strange style. In fact, it was a very common method of writing during a certain historical period. This was a genre. Apocalyptic is a literary genre that was popular among Jews from about 200 BC until about 200 AD. And it became adopted by Christians because Christianity came out of Judaism. So there were many things that the early Christians were doing because it was a Jewish practice. And apocalyptic literature was written by Jews initially under persecution, and then Christians who then later faced persecution themselves adopted this as a form of writing. So apocalyptic has a specific worldview and a specific style. So when I say it's a genre, you understand from that it is not just this book that is written in this symbolic style, but lots of other writings, but none of those ended up in the Bible, okay? Just this book. That's why it seems so different and so strange, because it is different from the rest of the Bible, but it is not unique, this is what I'm trying to say, in terms of its style. So the first thing that we know about apocalyptic writing is that it presents a particular worldview, a certain way of seeing the world, an attitude toward the world. So here it is. First of all, that God's people are suffering persecution. That the world is under the control of Satan and other evil powers, And the powers of evil operate to oppress the people of God through governments, through institutions, etc. And why do they do that? Because they want to destroy the people of God. But God will be victorious. God will destroy them, destroy evil, or if he does not, he will certainly vindicate the people of God after death. So the point is that apocalyptic literature is about the triumph of good over evil, okay, which will happen. But in the meantime, there is something which is expected of the people of God, and that is for them to remain faithful, okay? Patient and faithful no matter what. So that's the worldview. What about the literary style? Well, apocalyptic writings describe a glimpse into heaven. There is the person who is describing the vision has somehow been transported to heaven or seen the future or seen a glimpse into heaven. Heavenly guides explain what they see, and we always see this too. Sometimes the explanation is given by the Lord in the initial vision. Sometimes it's given by an angel. Sometimes it's given by one of the elders. All of these characteristics of apocalyptic are seen in the book of Revelation. And apocalyptic literature is characterized by symbolic numbers, animals, colors, cosmic signs. But everything is written in a symbolic style. So we're surrounded by symbols every day. So what I want you to understand about Revelation, why is it strange? Why does it look like this? What is apocalyptic? It's symbolic writing. Now, the reason why we have difficulty understanding it is because we're not part of that culture, okay? We understand the symbols of our culture. We're surrounded by symbols every day, and we don't have to decode them unless we're faced with something unusual. If you're not an Orthodox Christian and you've come into this church, you look around, you may see some symbols, and you're asking yourself, what does that mean? If I were to go into a Hindu temple, I would see symbols that I did not know necessarily what they meant. So symbolic literature is now literature in which there's a description of what John has experienced. He's using symbolic language to convey what he has experienced, and he's using the symbols of his culture. And his culture is Jewish Hellenistic in the first century Roman Empire. So let's talk about the symbols of our culture. I just want you to understand what this is. So symbols have meaning. We see this. There's no words on it. You would know immediately what to do. This is a stop sign, right? So if you're driving in some Arabic country and you see this, you're not going to say, oh, I don't know what to do, right? It's Arabic writing, but it's in the shape of a stop sign. The color is red. You know exactly what to do. Okay, why? Because you understand the symbol, not because you understand the writing. So some symbols are informational, right? And you see this. You don't, when, you know, you pull up to a parking space, oh, there's a parking space, and then you see the handicap sign. You don't have to say, well, what does that mean again? You immediately know what it is. You don't even think, can I park there? Because you're familiar with it. What about this symbol? What is this a symbol of? Do you know? Have you seen this symbol? Yes, the library. This is a symbol of the library. Now, sometimes you need special education to understand a symbol. Musical notation is all symbolic. A sharp, a flat, a note, a whole note, a half note, a quarter note, treble clef, bass clef. It means nothing to you. But if you're a musician, then you understand the meaning of these symbols. Here's a symbol that everybody knows, especially little children. Okay, why do they know that? It's part of our culture. You know, 100 years ago, this symbol did not exist. You would have shown this to people. They would not know what it means. How about this symbol? This is the Nike swoosh, right? Everybody knows what that means. It's known internationally, okay? So some symbols are known in a particular culture. The donkey and the elephant, that's a political symbol, all right? Those are political symbols. Donkey and an elephant are known in the culture. In our culture, you show this in some other part of the world, they're not going to know what it is. They'll know the swoosh, but they won't know our symbols. What about this? Recycling, symbol of recycling. That's a newer symbol. Windows, you see this. The cross is a very old symbol. Now, all of these symbols you recognized, but you recognize them because of where you live and when you live. Okay, so our ability to recognize it and decode this depends upon our exposure to that symbol. So here's another one. And I'm asking you the question, though, who would recognize this? This is not the National Rifle Association. NRA today would be national. Who knows what the NRA originally was? National Recovery Act. This was from something which, this was a poster from the Depression. Roosevelt started this this program during the Great Depression. So again, what this means depends upon your exposure. If you're too young, you're not going to know. Apparently everybody's too young here. How about this? Something that was very familiar in World War II, the stars, blue stars in a window meant that you had three sons serving in the war. If one was embroidered over with gold, it meant that that son had died. Okay, that's what they would call a parent, a gold star parent, that is a child who died. So this is something that was very familiar to my parents' generation, but you show this to somebody who's younger and they may not know what it means. How about this? Facebook. So meanings of symbols can also change. When I was in college, Apple was the Beatles' record label. But today, something entirely different, right? A symbol can have a different meaning depending upon who's viewing it or how it appears, right? So here you have a Star of David. If you're Jewish, this is a beautiful symbol. It's a symbol of your national identity, of your religious faith, a symbol of Israel. But what happens if we see it like this? As it evokes a very different reaction, doesn't it? So symbols invoke a response because they have meaning. And that's what we have to remember about the book of Revelation. It's written in symbolic language because symbols can have a very powerful meaning. Okay? So according to how we view it, the stars and stripes, if we're, you know, patriotic Americans who love our country, we see the stars and stripes. It has a beautiful meaning to us. It has something important. It's something we cherish, something we treasure. I'm speaking to you in the South. This is also a symbol, which is how are the stars and bars identified? Does everybody view them positively? No. For some people, they're a symbol of the South, a symbol of a pride from where you come from, that you're a Southerner in the United States. But other people, African Americans, will see that as a symbol of oppression, right? So symbols have a different meaning depending upon who is viewing it. So some symbols can pretty much never have a neutral meaning. You see a swastika, right? Especially a swastika with this red background, as you're seeing here. And immediately this has a negative meaning, unless, of course, you're a neo-Nazi, then it doesn't have a negative meaning. But for most of us, the vast majority, this has a negative meaning. But it's more than that. When I show you this, you're not just thinking, oh, that's a swastika. You don't just identify it and know what it means. It immediately triggers in your mind a lot of things having to do with World War II, the destruction, the people who died, the war, the loss of life, the troop movements, the austerity, the destruction of cities and landmarks and all kinds of things. So with this one symbol, it evokes much, much, much more than just what the symbol means. Do you understand what I'm trying to convey to you? Okay, so here's the question. What does all of this have to do with the book of Revelation? Well, the symbols of the book of Revelation had a specific meaning to the people to whom the book was addressed 1900 years ago. And it's written in symbolic language that they could understand. So if we wish to understand the apocalypse, we have to learn what the symbols meant to those people, okay? To the people to whom it was originally intended, and then that way we can understand it. We can't just choose to make up the meaning in our own minds. We can't decide out of our own imagination, this is what I think it means, because that's kind of delusional. Sometimes people say, well, God, you know, I have prayed and God told me that this is what this means. Or I have some kind of special insight. That's not the way to go about this, because that's really not what we do in biblical studies. We want to find out what it meant to the original audience, okay? So here's a symbol that is well established. Everybody kind of chuckled when they saw it. This symbol is the golden arches, McDonald's, okay? We all know what this stands for. It's like I said, every child sees it. They, especially if it has one of those places where they can play, they all want to stop there. What if 1900 years from now somebody finds a symbol and decides it means Mexico? Would they be correct? course not. Of course they're not correct. Because it has a meaning. We know what it means. This is what it means today. I can't decide that it means something else, even if I live a long time in the future. So imagine this. The book of Revelation is written in the first century. We understand the symbols of our culture that I showed you, windows or the Nike swoosh or whatever. If we were to project ourselves forward 1900 years in the future, somebody finds that symbol and says, this is what I think it means, and God has told me this is what the Nike swoosh means. I think the Nike swoosh is a boomerang. I think the Nike swoosh, that's really the symbol of Australia. They didn't know it's the Nike swoosh. Can they change the meaning? Are they accurate? Of course not. You would say, well, wait a minute, you need to find out what that symbol meant in that culture. That's what we're talking about, the book of Revelation. Just because it's in the Bible doesn't mean that people can simply change the meaning because that's what they decide, or because they think that they are imbued with somehow special insight, okay? So that's what we do. With the book of Revelation, as with every book of the Bible, we must begin with the historical context, okay? So the people who don't do that and interpret the symbols according to their own opinion or their imagination, they're distorting the meaning, okay? They're misusing the book, they're distorting the book, all right? And they are either ignorant, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, or they're charlatans. And we've seen a lot of those in past history, haven't we? Okay, we've seen people who are intentionally deceiving people to manipulate, or they are deluded. So here's an example of a van. It has a date, May 21st, 2011. That wasn't too long ago. I'm sure you all remember that Harold Camping, Brother Harold Camping of Family Radio, was predicting the Lord's return, the rapture, on May 21st, 2011. And I first learned about this a couple years before it happened, and I could not wait for that date to come. I could, because I was going to tune in on May 22nd, 2011, to see what he had to say, okay, because he was so convinced. Now, I would turn on Family Radio every once in a while, because sometimes you just hear Bible readings, and sometimes I'd be driving in my car, I get to hear some scripture, and every once in a while I turn it on, and there he is, and this is what I heard him predicting this date, and people saying, but what if it doesn't happen, brother? Oh, he was sure. He was absolutely certain it was going to happen. So what happened? Many people believed him, and he had a very, and I ordered their literature so I could see on what he based his date. And it's this kind of very convoluted, there are a lot of people who get into these very convoluted calculations about dates and things like this. It's based on the year of the flood. He went back and decided when he thought the year of the flood took place. He had all these really complicated date kind of chronology. He came up with his date. Now, what happened is a lot of people relying on him, believing, because they didn't know better, because they didn't come to this, you see. They didn't know better. They didn't know what Revelation was about. I'm not saying because of me. I'm talking about because they're not understanding Revelation historically. So they don't know what it means. And they mortgage their houses. They quit their jobs. They maxed out their credit cards because, of course, Jesus is coming back. So I don't have to worry about those. And they went around the country preaching that Jesus was returning. Part of it, the reason why I didn't really understand it, is because they were telling people to repent, but they also believed in predestination. So I didn't understand that part myself. But this is what they did. So, of course, it didn't happen. And then also they make a mockery of Christianity because, of course, this makes the news. And people say, oh, these are the Christians, and they're all a bunch of idiots. So there were people who were having parties. I don't know if you heard about this. They're kind of have like rapture parties because they were going to wait around to see if Jesus came. So this is harmful. It did real harm to people. I'm making jokes about it, but it did real harm to real people who were very sincere, okay? And then it made the rest of Christians who don't believe this, because this is a little minority. This is kind of a fringe group who would do this, but it makes the rest of us all look like idiots. So this is one of my favorites from this, because here you see this billboard was posted at the not far from our university. Our university is on a hill. At the foot of the hill was this billboard. And my favorite, there's like a little seal in the upper left-hand corner, and it says, "The Bible guarantees it." Okay? The Bible guarantees it. Really? The Bible guarantees this? Remember, this is all Harold Camping's interpretation. And he gave a lot of reasons why he's been studying the Bible for 50 years, and I read all of his brochures, and he was so convinced that he was correct. But of course we know he was not. So let's talk about what Revelation is. Revelation is prophecy. There's no question about that. It has a future fulfillment, okay? But it also has a message for us today. Even though I'm telling you historically had a meaning back then, it also has a message and a meaning for today. But the purpose of Revelation was never to serve as a roadmap to predict the end of the world. And people who use it in that way are guilty of misusing it. Now, I will tell you that I understand that people come to these kinds of talks, and perhaps you're hoping that I'm going to tell you the signs of the end times and when the end of the world is going to happen, and you're probably already disappointed. Okay, so I apologize for that. And I get it. Okay, I get it because I was, like everybody else, I was in college and I read a book called The Late Great Planet Earth. Have you ever heard of it? Well, I read it in about 1977. Now it's around the 28th or 29th printing, and the guy was completely wrong, Hal Lindsey was completely wrong, but I believed it because I didn't know any better. So he said, well, this is what's going to happen. Here's when you know the end of the world is coming. The Soviet Union will get together with Red China, that's what we used to call it, Red China. And when the European Common Market has 10 members, those are the 10 crowns, you know, on the seven heads of the beast, and that was my mind was swimming because I was trying to keep all of this straight in my head, right? Because I didn't want to follow the Antichrist. That's what I'm afraid of. I want to know who the Antichrist is, so I don't follow him. Okay? So now, he was completely wrong, because there is no more Soviet Union. There's no European Common Market. Now it's the European Union. It's got a lot of members. Completely wrong. And the book is still selling. And he's making a fortune. Okay? Like the Left Behind people and everybody else who's profiting from this. It, rather than saying, well, maybe I don't know what I'm doing. Finally, Harold Camping, I mean, at least he had to admit that maybe he was wrong. It took him a while. But he set a second date. He said Jesus, do you know what he said? He said that Jesus really did return invisibly on May 21st. But I'm serious. But the real end of the world will come on October 21st of 2011. When it didn't happen and he was still alive, he said, well, maybe I don't know when Jesus is coming back. I said, well, welcome to, you know, the rest of us. That's exactly right. But my point is that people create these ideas in their mind and they profit from it, or they believe themselves to be special or important. So we're talking about the fact that this is a misuse of the book. All right, so can it be used to predict the end of the world? No. The two most important things to remember when interpreting the Bible, this goes for every book of the Bible, is context. Context, there's a literary context and a historical context. We all understand that. We all understand what it means to take something out of context, but somehow when it comes to the Bible, we think it's perfectly okay to take a verse from here and a verse from here and a verse from here. That's what they do. A verse from here, a verse from here, a verse from here. This is what people do. And they concoct a scenario that it does not reflect the message of the Bible, okay, or even the actual book. So what else do we see? Context and purpose. Why was the book written? Was John trying to give us a roadmap, a guide to the end of the world? That's an original question. No, he wasn't, okay? And that's why it can't be used for that. He had a specific purpose, which we will discuss. Now, there's information about the end times in Revelation, but not in the way that people think, okay? So here's what happens when we'll talk about something like the rapture. We'll do the rapture at the end. Okay, so we're going to begin with logic in the book of Revelation. There's a premise that no author writes a book to an audience that he does not expect them to understand. I'm here speaking to people who are here because they understand English. You understand my point because you speak the same language as I do. John is writing a book to a group of people to give them a message. And some people say, well, the message is just for the first, the letters of the seven churches, and after that it's all future prophecy. Why would he write that? What does they need to know what's going to happen at the end of the world if it's not something that they're facing right then and there? Do you understand what I'm saying? He's concerned about these people at this time facing this crisis. The letters to the seven churches we're going to see are to a group of people who are facing an immediate crisis. That's why he's writing the book. He's not writing it so that we can meet 2,000 years later in Houston, Texas, and talk about it. That's not why he's writing the book. Can you see the logic behind that? So we have to remember that the Bible also demands that we use our intelligence. Yes, our intelligence. Okay, so he writes, every author writes a book that the audience will understand. So John knows that his audience will understand the book, and they did understand it. The problem is that for us today, we don't understand it, okay? Over time, the meaning of the symbols changed. People lost the understanding of the symbols because the culture changed. Just like you didn't recognize the NRA poster from the Depression, okay? And that's not that long ago. And it's the same culture, it's American culture, but you didn't recognize it. Other people won't recognize other things. Okay, so what did Christ say about whether or not we can know the time of the end? Here's another thing that's really important. So Revelation is not a roadmap to the end of the world. Why not? To describe how and it's going to happen and when it's going to happen. Because Jesus said, can we know when the end will come? Jesus said no. Jesus said you can't know. And when people would raise this with, I'm sorry, I'm kind of harping on Harold Camping, but he's just the most recent example of this. He said, oh, no, that's wrong. Jesus wants you to know. But Jesus says, clearly, you can't know, and no one knows. So what happens is, when we're looking at the Bible, these are some very general rules for biblical interpretation, which I hope you will remember. One of the most important rules is that we try to understand the obscure parts by referring to the clear parts, not vice versa. So Jesus said very clearly, you can't know the time of the end. Okay, so you cannot make that obscure. You can't obscure that. There are very clear statements in the scriptures. We use those clear statements to understand the parts we don't understand. Does that make sense to you? We don't take the parts that we don't understand and use those to muck up the parts that we do understand. And that's what happens. They say, well, oh, no, Jesus wants you to know the time of the end. But didn't he say you can't know? Oh, yeah, but here, and then they cite all these other verses, and they concoct a kind of scenario that obscures what really should be very clear. So Jesus said you can't know the time of the end. It will come like a thief in the night. That is, at a time that we don't expect. The thieves don't come. You're not standing there with a baseball bat waiting to whack the thief over the head as he breaks in through your window. He comes at a time that you don't expect, just like the Lord will come at a time that we don't expect. Now, here's something else which I hope you will take away from this. What we really need to know, that is what Christ wished us to know, was what he clearly taught. There are things that we have to know, okay? And he taught these things very clearly. The rest are things we're not supposed to know because it would really be to our detriment. So if there was something we really needed to know when the end of the world would take place and he wanted us to know that, he wouldn't couch it in all kinds of weird symbols, you know, and kind of obscure sayings. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that he doesn't leave us to guess about things that are important. The things that are necessary for our salvation, he expresses very clearly, okay? He also, I'm sure, did not want us to know because it would be harmful for us to know the time of the end. Why would it be harmful? What do you think? It would cause chaos for us to know the time of the end? What would be the natural reaction? Exactly. We would start sinning and we say, well, I have all this time to repent. We do that now when we don't know. We do that now when we're young. Well, I'll repent when I'm older. I'll get serious about God when I have time, when I'm older, when I'm retired. But we don't know the time of the end because we don't know the time of our own death. And that is the end. The chances are that our own death will come before the coming of the Lord. Or maybe, I mean, we don't really know when he will come, but so far he hasn't come back. So when the Lord left this earth, At the ascension, that's the first time the promise was given to us that he would return, but they never said when. The early Christians were all thinking that he was going to come back very, very soon. But when the ascension happened and the apostles were looking up in the sky, this was something new. They'd never seen him go up in the sky like that. They were distracted by men standing there, men in white, who said, "Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking up in the sky? This Jesus whom you have seen depart like this will return in the same manner." But they didn't say when. Will it be, it hasn't been 1,000 years? Hasn't been 2,000 years? Will it be 3,000 years? Will it be 2,020? I mean, we don't know. But the point is, we have to be prepared for the end at any moment, and the end is our death. Okay? So, and everyone who has ever predicted the end has been wrong. So, what are the chances that today somebody will be right? I'm amazed that people continue to try to predict that. So why do people keep predicting it? Spiritual pride? Okay. Okay, a belief that somebody has special insight? Harold Camping believed, yeah, he knew. He was convinced. Okay, a desire to feel important? I think this happens. Desire to manipulate others if there's an evil intent. We have seen this here in Texas. You had the Waco incident some years ago where there was somebody who really believed, maybe he was just a malevolent, I'm not sure if it was malevolent or if he was delusional, but obviously this cost people their lives, you know, about that. So, or also, this is something else. There's nothing else to do. If you believed you're already saved and you're going to go to heaven, what is there left to do? Figure out when Jesus is coming back. So I don't mean that to be flippant or disrespectful, but I've wondered why so many people are so intent on figuring out when Jesus is coming back. And I think, well, maybe it's because they're already saved, so there's nothing really else to do. So that's what we'll do. So the Orthodox Church feels this way about the return of the Lord. We believe what the Lord said. We're scriptural, okay? Jesus said no one will know the day or the hour, and that's what we believe, and that's what we accept. So here's an icon of the bridegroom that we have, and we remind ourselves of this at Holy Week, that the bridegroom will come in the middle of the night. This is a reflection of the parables in the Synoptic Gospels, that he will come at a time that we don't expect. So actually, every time somebody says he was coming back and this, or look at what's happening in the Middle East, and Iran is getting nuclear weapons, and there's Israel, and all these things are happening. I think, because actually Jesus alludes to this in the Synoptic Gospels, and he talks about the days of Noah. People were eating and drinking and getting married right up to the very end. They did not see what was happening. It will come at a time that we don't expect. That's the point. When everything, you know, maybe when we have universal world peace, which is, I think, impossible, but we seem to be on the edge of world peace and we're also enlightened and everything is great, and, you know, that's when he'll come back, the time that we don't expect. And that's what he told us. And if we believe him, then that's what we should expect. So why is Revelation so strange? Well, apocalyptic literature was part of the Jewish tradition. The first Christians, having been Jewish Christians, accepted this and also adopted this. Remember that the first members of the church never said, well, we're Christians now, we're not Jewish anymore, so we're going to drop everything that's Jewish. We're not going to go to the synagogue, we're not going to read the scriptures. They never said that. They never thought they were starting a new religion. So they continued to participate in many Jewish things, including the synagogue and the temple, and writing apocalyptic works. Okay? So first of all, it's written in a strange manner because this is a Jewish tradition, apocalyptic writing. Secondly, the author, John, was functioning as a prophet, and he was inspired by the prophecies of the Old Testament, and the prophecies of the Old Testament likewise are very, they're not always clear. Okay, they're somewhat obscure, and they have many layers of meaning. This is something else we have to talk about with Revelation. He had a profound spiritual experience. When Paul likewise had an experience of heaven, which he describes in 2 Corinthians. And he says, you know, I was transported up to the third heaven. Does he describe it for us? Doesn't even try. He said, words can't describe it. When there are people who have these profound experiences, they find that they cannot describe these things in human language. And that's because God exists in a realm beyond human language and thought. So if we are ever blessed to participate in this type of thing, and we're blessed to glimpse a kind of existence, divine existence, there are no words to express that. Now, that's true even in our own earthly lives. Okay, let's ask somebody who's in love. How does it feel to be in love? What do you think about your girlfriend, your boyfriend? And they'll say, I feel like running through a field of daisies, and, you know, the sun is shining, and, you know. Or you ask somebody who's lost someone close to them, was recently, my world is black. Well, look at the sun is shining. What do you mean the world is black? We turn to images and symbols to express things that are inexpressible, right? That's what John is doing in Revelation. What he experienced, he didn't see something with visible human eyes. He experienced something and he was told to send a message. And sometimes symbols and images are more powerful. So it's a combination of the fact that apocalyptic is a genre, that he's writing prophecy, and third, that these kinds of things go beyond human language and understanding, and we turn to imagery, okay, to describe experiences. And sometimes the image is more powerful. That image of the swastika that I showed you earlier, that's that's much more powerful than me saying Nazi Germany. I say the words Nazi Germany, you say, okay, I show you the swastika, you know, it's so much more powerful, right? Okay, so here are a few examples of modern apocalyptic for you to interpret. I wrote these, okay? So what I'm doing here is I'm trying to show you how, if you are part of the culture, you'll understand the symbols, okay? So here's my modern apocalyptic writing. I will read it for you. The crescent moon loomed larger. While the eagle slept, two silver birds flew above the wall and tore into the apple. The great and the small, the finest and the bravest perished. From ashes to ashes, from dust to dust, the bull and the bear stood still as the smoke rose from the twisted steel mountain. What's it about? 9/11. You probably got that before I finished reading. How long did it take me to read that? 30 seconds? How is it that you understood that? How did you know that it's 9/11? You see how it's the symbols of our culture. Let's start at the beginning. What's the crescent moon? Islam. It's looming larger. What does that mean? It's a growing threat, right? The eagle is? And what does it mean that it's sleeping? It's not aware. It's not paying attention. That's right. The two silver birds are? The planes. Flew above the wall. Anybody catch that symbol? This is Lower Manhattan. That is Wall Street. Okay. Tore into the apple. The apple is the symbol of? New York City, called the Big Apple, right? The great and the small, the finest and the bravest perish. The great and the small, there were people who were, you know, financiers. You know, and literally every employee there were some financial institutions, Cantor, I'm thinking of Cantor Fitzgerald. Every single employee died. And some of them were, you know, big shots financiers on Wall Street. And then there were people who were the secretaries and the janitors and the busboys and things like this. Everybody died. The great and the small, finest and the bravest. Finest, New York's finest are the cops. New York's bravest are the firefighters. Ashes to ashes. The dust, we've all saw pictures of the ash and the dust. The bull and the bear, the symbols of? Wall Street, the stock exchange closed for a week. That's why it stood still. The Twisted Steel Mountain is the wreckage, which we all saw pictures of. That wasn't that hard, okay? Why? Because you know the symbols. Let's try another one. As the Razorback perished, an eagle flew above screaming, "The end is near! The end is near!" Gigantic forces converged for the final battle. A donkey volunteer stepped forward, the son of his father. From the west, an elephant carrying a single star lumbered onto the battlefield to respond to the challenge, another son of his father. What's it about? pick one image if you don't know immediately.
Gore versus Bush.
Okay, he says Gore versus Bush. Father says Gore versus Bush. How do you, so it's an election. You know it's an election, apocalyptic, because of the elephant and donkey imagery. You know that because you're living in America. Okay, you know the symbol. So who is the Razorback?
Clinton,
because he is from
Arkansas.
That's right. What does it mean in terms of politics that you're perishing? Because Clinton is alive, right? So how is he perishing? His term is over. That's exactly right. His term is over. So what is the battle in terms of election politics? The battle is the election. Okay, so the donkey volunteer is Al Gore. How did you figure that out, Father?
Well, because I connected with Clinton, and also his father was a senator, so I'm assuming that's what you're talking about.
The son of the father. Yet Al Gore he's the son of his father because his father's name was also Al Gore. He's a volunteer because he's from what state? Tennessee, which is the volunteer state. Okay? And then George W. Bush is the elephant. He comes from the Lone Star State, Texas. He's carrying this. I had to explain that to you. You go, oh. I mean, I'm in Texas, for goodness sake. You guys go, oh, a single star. The single star is the Lone Star State. I'm shocked. I thought you'd get that before anything else. And his father's name is also George Bush, okay? So that was an example. Okay, it's another one, since you're doing so well. The young, audacious one waved aloha to the Crimson Campus and headed westward to the land of Lincoln, blowing a strong wind of change as the old cowboy rode off into the sunset. His name is 32. Who's this?
Obama.
What makes you think it's Obama? Okay, he's from Hawaii. He's waving aloha to Crimson Campus, which is?
Harvard.
Sorry, folks. Harvard is the Crimson Campus. Why is he the young, audacious one? He was young when he became president. He's audacious because he wrote a book called The Audacity of Hope. Okay, and now I wrote this in 2008, right after the election, and everybody... I just invented this one. So I wrote it on the board, and the whole class got it before I was even finished. Why? Because they were very tuned to the election, and it was fresh in their minds. His book was The Audacity of Hope. So he's going westward to the land of Lincoln, which is Illinois, blowing a strong wind of change. Why? Because change was his motto, absolutely. And the wind part is, where did he go to live? The Windy City, Chicago. Okay, as the old cowboy rode off into the sunset. Who's that? George W. Bush. And his name is 32. So what I did for is I took A, I made it 1, B was 2, C was 3, and I added up Obama, and I got the number 32. Okay, so that's how I got that. I can do whatever I want, okay, because it's my apocalypse, all right? It's my apocalypse, okay? Under the Greek rules, under the Hebrew rules, it would not be 32, but I'm using my rules, okay? I was not going to go look, write it out in Hebrew and figure it out, okay? I don't have that kind of time. This is one. Here's another one. Bang! Fleet Patriot Day feet sped toward the cradle of liberty, counting down the 26. At the tape, two wolves, two blasts brought Freedom Trail tears. Three lost, but still strong. Boston Marathon bombing. And the reason why you got that easily is because it was very recent, and it was in the news again because of the anniversary. Okay, Patriots Day is the day that they run the marathon. The Cradle of Liberty is Boston. The 26 is the marathon number of miles. The two wolves are the brothers who are from Chechnya, and that's the symbol of Chechnya. The two blasts, the two bombs, the Freedom Trail is something that Boston is famous for. Three people died, and the motto was Boston Strong. But your exposure to the symbols and how much is in your consciousness really determines how quickly you interpret these things. Now, since you're all so clever, I'm going to give you another one. This is the last one we will do. Okay? The beaver cried from sea unto sea, "The end is near, the end is near." After 144 months, straight from his heart, the Christian lay perishing while a gritty city saint came down from the royal mountain. But the sound of a harp could be heard as a new maple bud burst forth to stampede onward to Bytown. Any ideas? Not a clue.
Maple and the Stampede, that's Canada.
That's right. Now, they speak English, okay? And they're mostly, and they're our neighbors, and you didn't get the clues, except that you noticed that something, the maple leaf, it kind of sounds like it might be Canadian. But my point is this, you easily got the other ones. This one you don't because you're not part of their culture. Okay, so let's talk about it. The beaver is a national symbol of Canada. Their national motto is from sea unto sea. The end is near, it's the political, I borrowed that from the other one. 144 months is 12 times 12. The Christian was the Prime Minister Jacques Chrétien, whose name means Christian in French. He served for 12 years. 12 years times 12 months is 144 months. When he retired, he wrote his memoir, which was called Straight From My Heart, okay? The gritty city saint, that is the person who replaced him as the prime minister, was a grit. That's their term for the Labor Party. He came from Montreal, which is called the City of Saints. He came down from Royal Mountain. Montreal means Royal Mountain. But he didn't last very long as prime minister because the sound of a harp could be heard. Anybody know the current prime minister? Stephen Harper. He's a new maple bud, burst forth from Stampede. What's that identified with Stampede? The city is? He's from Calgary. And their motto is Onward. And he went to Bytown, which was the original name of the Canadian capital, Ottawa. Okay, their original name was Bytown. Okay, but the reason why I threw this in there is so that you recognize how easy it is to understand apocalyptic if you know the symbols and how much more difficult it is. You know, if I'd given you this as an assignment and said you figure it out, you probably could have. But do you understand what I'm trying to say? So when we're reading the book of Revelation, if we want to understand it, we have to understand its meaning in its original historical context. Not because that's where the meaning remains, but because once we understand that, then we can apply it to us. That's what we do with the Bible. And that's the rule for every book of the Bible. Okay. So, who was the author of Revelation and why did he write the book? So, the author of Revelation is John. He identifies himself as John. According to tradition, he was John, one of the 12. He died very old. He was responsible for the Church of Asia. And for the Romans, Asia is Asia Minor. That's modern-day Turkey, not the Far East, okay? Now, he was in prison or in exile on the island of Patmos, and at the time that he's away, separated from the Church of Asia, they are facing a serious crisis. And he has a vision, and he is told to share this vision with the churches. So here we have the beginning of Revelation called the prologue, and he tells us it's a revelation through Jesus Christ, from God the Father, to make known to his servant John what was going to happen. Okay, everything that he saw. So here we have the beginning and the initial blessing. We call this a macharism. Blessed is the one who reads and those who hear. For the time is near. For the time is near. Well, then either he was completely wrong, or we're wrong in thinking that the visions go to the future, the end of the world. Clearly, there has to be a future component, his prophecy, but it's primarily a present-day message for John and his congregation, okay? So here's the prologue. Also, John, this is the letter format, to the seven churches in Asia, grace to you and peace from the one who was, is, and is to come. And from the seven spirits, it is addressed to these churches. Here is where he is. Let me see if I could make my little pointer point to Patmos there. It's a little island right here. Sorry, it's moving over. Right above the letter O in Patmos. That's the island, and these are the churches he's writing to, which is now Asia Minor. Okay, which is now in Turkey. So, and from Jesus Christ, these are initial words. We don't have time to go into it. So after this, he's going to describe his vision, what causes him to write. He shares their tribulation and the kingdom and their endurance, their patient endurance, that he was on the island of Patmos on account of the word of God, probably because he had been preaching and the testimony of Jesus. And he was in the spirit. So this is a spiritual experience. This is an out of body, we could say, experience, an experience of ecstasy. He was in the spirit. He was not sleeping. It's not a dream, but it's a vision. It's a spiritual vision. And on the Lord's day, when he heard behind himself a loud voice like a trumpet, and it is described. What did he hear? He looks around to see the voice, and he sees seven gold lampstands, and one like the Son of Man in the midst of the lampstands. And all of these things are descriptions which are borrowed from, we could say, the Old Testament. But John is searching for imagery to describe the experience which he has experienced. So what is he going to use? He's going to use the imagery he knows, and that's the scriptures. So that's why so much of Revelation sounds like parts of the Old Testament, okay? Because he's using the images that he's familiar with, and that's the Bible. So he sees the one like the Son of Man in a long robe with a long, it says girdle, it's a belt around his chest, and his head and his hair are white like wool. His eyes are like a flame of fire. His feet are like burnished bronze, and his voice is like the sound of many waters. And then, as we will go on to see, there's a sword coming out of his mouth, and in his right hand he's holding these stars. And if you were to really depict it, these are obviously icons. If you were to describe or to depict visually the way John describes it, it would be a very bizarre thing. So we have to understand that John isn't saying that he saw something that looked like this, but that he experienced something that was kind of like this. So the symbols of Revelation point to what he experienced. Okay, so he experiences Christ, okay? And of course, when he has this experience, he falls down at his feet, he's dead, and he's touched by the one like the Son of Man, this is Christ, who reassures him and says that, here's what I want you to do. I want you to write down what you see, and I want you to send this to the seven churches that are in Asia, and they are listed, okay? So what is the tribulation and the patient endurance that John was experiencing and he was talking to his congregation, his churches about? The historical context of the book of Revelation is what we call the emperor cult and Roman persecution. So what's the emperor cult? Well, the very first emperor was Augustus Caesar. He becomes emperor after the assassination of his uncle, Julius Caesar. And when he becomes emperor, Augustus proclaims Julius Caesar to have been a god. He deifies Julius. Well, Julius Caesar maybe was kind of important, but Augustus was much more important and much more impressive, had more accomplishments than Julius ever did. So this is called the beginning of the emperor cult. It was a formal honor conferred upon somebody after his death. So this formal honor conferred upon someone after an emperor after his death. So when Augustus died, because he had created the precedent for Julius, Augustus' successor Tiberius proclaimed Augustus to have been a god. Then when he died, his successor Gaius Caligula proclaimed Tiberius to be a god, and so on and so forth. So it became the practice. It was a custom. Now, Domitian's father, Vespasian, the first of the Flavian dynasty, knew that this was just an honorific thing, and he actually made a joke about it. He was dying, and he said, "I fear I am becoming a god." Okay, now they weren't stupid. These were intelligent people. They didn't think that they were really gods, but they understood that it was a way of honoring the emperor after he died. Okay, and nobody really expected to be worshipped, but Domitian was different. He was the third of the Flavian emperors. So Vespasian was the first, then Titus, now Domitian. Domitian, it seems, wanted to be worshipped as a god while he was still alive. And that was something different, okay? So he is the emperor at the time that John is writing the book of Revelation. So he wants to be worshipped. And so most of the people say, well, we don't care, but they have lots of gods. They also engaged in idolatry, so to most of the Romans this was not a problem. And they also understood that the emperor represents the empire, okay? Sort of like this, okay? But it's true. People see our president, I'm talking about outside of the country, people see our president, he represents the United States. They say, okay, that's Obama, he's the United States president. That's a fact. Okay? So they believed that paying respect to the emperor by worshiping him was to respect the empire, kind of like we have saluting the flag. Jehovah's Witnesses don't do that because they believe it's idolatry. Okay, we don't see it that way. The rest of us don't see it that way. How were these Roman, the people in the city, not just citizens, but anyone in the empire, supposed to show their respect to the emperor? By burning incense in front of his statue and offering a prostration in front of his statue. And also he would be addressed as my Lord and my God, Domitian. When they would issue edicts, they would say, our Lord and God, Domitian, and then they would give whatever order he wanted. So for the Romans, it's not a big deal. They're already idolatrous. However, the Jews were exempt from emperor worship. Jews were exempt. They didn't have to do this. And this only left a problem for Christians. So, how would you feel if we had to bow down and worship, okay, the emperor as a Christian? What about if it was this? You're laughing, but that could happen. I mean, that's what happened to them. The reason why I'm putting Obama's picture here is so that you understand that this was a reality to these people whom John was writing to. You know, this is something that we see and we say, okay, well, we would never do that, but what if it's you and the times are these and it's do this or die? Because that's what it's about. That's what Revelation is about. Judaism was exempt. Why? Because it was an ancient, legal, and recognized religion. Christianity, on the other hand, was new. Romans didn't like newness. We love new things. People want the newest phone, the newest car, the updated program. The Romans were not like that. Romans liked antiquity and stability and tradition. But Christianity was new, it was foreign, it was secretive, and it was strange. And Christians were monotheists, and they were opposed to idolatry, and yet they didn't have any legal protection because they weren't Jews, and they lacked the protections that the Jews had. So Christians refused to worship the emperor or his statue, and because of this, because the Romans did not understand that, they understood if a Jew refused to worship the statue, but they didn't understand about the Christians because they'd say, hey, you're not Jewish, you're from Cyrene, you're from Athens, you're from Corinth, why won't you bow down? Come on, it's just a little bit of incense, come on, bow down and worship, what's the big deal? They couldn't understand it, but they knew that Jesus had been executed by a Roman governor on a charge of treason. And so they put these two things together and they said, these people are treasonous and they deserve to be put to death. So the worship of the emperor became a loyalty test. Now, Domitian wanted to be worshipped as a god. The later emperors, many of whom were highly intelligent, very effective, many of the best emperors were the worst persecutors of Christians. People like Marcus Aurelius, okay, and Trajan continued to persecute Christians even though they knew full well that they were not God. But this had become a practice, a way of weeding out Christians whom they saw as a treasonous, subversive sect, okay? And the first Roman persecution had started under Nero about 30 years before. Nero had blamed the Christians for the fire of Rome. But Nero's persecution was very different. It was limited to the city of Rome. He blamed them for the fire, and after it was over, you know, however many months it took to execute the Christians, it was over. But when Domitian begins his persecution around the year in the 90s, 90 or 95, we're not exactly sure, this is empire-wide. It's not limited to people in one city. The crime is just being a Christian, not associating you with a fire or some other criminal activity. And it continued for over 200 years until Christianity was legalized. And that is the context of the book of Revelation.